ducks are eating 12,000-year-old meals.
Let's make that 1,200-year-old meals. Work that we've been doing up there has been looking at the food chains on the Arctic slope. The major work that I've been doing is to look at the interactions between the terrestrial, the land-based, and the marine food chains. The major reason we're interested is that the marine mammals of the North Slope are important, both to native subsistence hunting, and the bowhead whale, of course, is on the endangered species list. And so any industry activity out there will require that these organisms be considered when industry development moves offshore. My particular work has been looking at the effects of peat, which erodes off the tundra in large quantities on the nearshore marine food chains. Surprisingly enough, we found that once the peat gets into the marine water, it's passed on up the food chain in some of the little crustaceans, shrimp-like animals that are in the nearshore zone. And these then are eaten by birds and fish, and then that in that manner is passed up to the top of the food chain. Most of the offshore food chains are sort of powered by the plants and microscopic plants that live in the water column itself. As soon, however, as you get near the streams, the peat becomes far more important, and the fish that overwinter in the streams are dependent upon the peat, and the birds that come and nest in the tundra, primarily the old squaw ducks and the eiders and the phalaropes. These birds, which feed on the invertebrates that live in the ponds, are dependent upon the peat-based food webs to keep them going and for the successful rearing of their young.
Can you get you a little closer?
Sure. Right. Okay.
It's kind of hard to move around it. Now, when you say that the peat is consumed by the crustaceans, they're generally a scavenger. So are they eating? How are they raking the peat now?
Well, that's one of the major questions that we were looking into, and it turns out, of course, that peat is a very refractory compound. That is, it is not converted easily into organisms, and so apparently it goes through a food web in which bacteria attack the peat, and then that is passed into little animals that are called myofauna. These are small animals, little worms, etc., usually less than a millimeter or two. And these, in turn, are grazed upon by larger invertebrates, which are then grazed upon by the birds that feed in the ponds. The ponds and streams up there have a lot of insect larvae, primarily the midges, and which are called chironomids, and the small crustaceans, amphipods and mysids, also live in the ponds. And these are important food items to the ducks and birds.
So basically what's happening, let's see if I can paraphrase, make sure I understand it correctly. What's happening is that the peat is getting into the water, and there's a bacteria breaking it down, then the smallest invertebrate is consuming that, and it's just being passed up the chain.
All right.
It sounds like this would really concentrate the amount of peat in some in the higher animals.
It does. It's an effective means of passing substance that's available year-round. In other words, unlike green plants, which are frozen into the surface layer and there's no runoff from the tundra in the winter, which would supply recent vegetative material to the streams or ponds, the peat's there on a year-round basis because it sort of is a mantle over the entire tundra landscape. And since most of the ponds are thaw ponds that sort of are shallow and settle into the tundra, the peat is readily available year-round. The most efficient consumers of the peat appear to be these small insect larvae called chironomids. And we suspect that the chironomids are able to eat the peat directly and through bacterial populations in their intestinal tract, convert it directly into food for themselves.
Now, we've mentioned the ponds. Is this happening also in the saltwater environment?
We don't see much evidence that this process is important in the saltwater environments. Whenever we look at the fish that move from out of the rivers into the saltwater environments over the summer, we find that their food web changes entirely to organisms that are raised on marine phytoplankton. So that we have, in essence, then two distinct food webs that are supporting the marine birds, such as the old squaws and the anadromous fishes. In the winter, when they, with the fish this is, when the fish overwinter in the streams, it's then that they become dependent upon the peat, and their body carbon slowly turns over as they consume insect larvae into better than two-thirds peat-based support, whereas in the summer when they move into the marine environment, then they become marine carbon in content as they're dependent upon phytoplankton-based food webs.
On the fish, you say roughly as much as two-thirds they'll be based on the peat. What about the mammals and the birds up there?
The mammals on the North Slope are dependent entirely upon what we'd call recent terrestrial production. In other words, the lemmings, the caribou, all graze directly upon plants that are either living or are very recently dead, standing dead plants from, say, the previous couple of years' growth. When one looks at the larger carnivores, of course, such as foxes or weasels, wolverines, etc., these in turn, since they're feeding upon the lemmings or other grazers, they too are dependent upon recent growth of plants, unlike the old squaw ducks, which are feeding on the peat. Since, of course, some of the birds are taken by the foxes, there is a small contribution of peat carbon, even in the top trophic levels.
Basically, it's not significant for the mammals.
No.
Now, when we talk about peat, could you tell me what the peat is, how old it is, where it comes from?
All peat is the residue from the plant growth on the tundra that's been accumulating ever since the last ice age glaciers retreated and vegetation became reestablished on the North Slope. We look at the layer of peat and we can find small twigs in it that are derived from the little willows and small decumbent vegetation. We find remnants of moss and leaves. And as you get deeper and deeper in the peat, the material becomes more and more homogeneous and with less character to it. In the top 20 centimeters or so of the tundra, you have a thaw with each seasonal cycle. And the freeze-thaw cycle tends to shred the fibers in the vegetative material and render it into a very soft and crumbly type structure.
Now, the peat that the animals are existing on, is this peat that's from 5 years ago, 25 years ago? How old are the meals?
Well, since the major input of peat into the aquatic environments occurs at the lake shores or at the edge of the sea where the seawater is eroding the peat bluffs, the input of peat tends to be representative of the entire column of peat, which is approximately 10,000 years old at the bottom and, of course, is very recent at the top because that's just the remnants of plants that have been growing quite recently. So the mean age, the average age of the peat column is probably somewhere around 4,000 to 5,000 years old.
Now, you mentioned the worm. I can't remember what its name was, but is this animal equally eating, consuming the peat that's 10,000 years old and the peat that's 3 weeks old?
We don't really know. We suspect that once the peat becomes incorporated into the permafrost horizon, which on the North Slope is only just a foot or two under the surface, it probably undergoes very little change from there on. So there's no reason to suspect that the deeper layers of peat are very much more or less edible, shall we say, than the stuff that's right under the surface of the vegetation. I suspect that the recent vegetation from plants that died within the last few years or are standing dead are a lot more edible, shall we say, than the stuff that's in the actual peat column. But by the time it's buried a few inches, I suspect it doesn't change much in composition.
So in other words, the permafrost is giving us a deep freeze effect. They've got fresh 10,000-year-old peat.
Well, that's essentially the truth.
I've jumped around quite a bit. Is there anything that I haven't asked that you'd like to include? Because I'm, you know, something that maybe we didn't cover as we talked.
Well, it's just I've found it extremely interesting in the concept that the North Slope, where the plant life is restricted to a very, very short season, the actual amount of plant carbon that is fixed by photosynthesis over the Arctic summer is very small compared to the terrestrial, to the temperate zones. And as a result, when one considers that these organisms that live up there on a year-round basis have to have some kind of energy source that will keep them going even when the fresh vegetative material isn't available to them. And since the fish, namely the ciscos, which are a type of whitefish, the least ciscos, the broad whitefish and the humpback whitefish, these fish, which are important both from subsistence fisheries use and from in just the sense that they're the major populations in the Colville River, which is the largest river on the North Slope, these fish are sort of into a fossil fuel subsidy, shall we say. We think of our own selves as dependent on a fossil fuel subsidy to bring us food, in that it's trucked up from California using petroleum hydrocarbons. Well, up here, the fossil fuel subsidy is something that's very direct, in that it's actually supporting the animals themselves, and they're not dependent upon what is growing on the tundra that particular summer. So they have a built-in mechanism to handle a large variation from year to year.
You've done your work primarily on the Colville River, I understand. Is this your study, is this, do you think this is consistent all the way across the North Slope, Canada, Greenland, Iceland, or not Iceland, Siberia?
I suspect this mechanism is pretty much pan-Arctic. In other words, anywhere in the high latitudes where you find peat bogs accumulating and erosive processes putting the peat back into the aquatic environment, I suspect that the same process is important. Where the surface production or the microscopic plant production in the water is greater than on the North Slope, then the peat contribution will be smaller. But I suspect this mechanism is pretty much the same all across Alaska, Siberia, and indeed even in Iceland, where the peat bogs accumulate, and for example in the Shetland Islands north of England.
I'm maybe reading between the lines and reading too much, but it sounds like you believe that because of the peat, the North Slope is able to support a greater amount of life than it would be otherwise.
I don't think that's reading too much into it, because I think it's safe to say that whenever you have an energy source available, nature is quick to take advantage of it. And as the saying goes, if nature makes it, nature eats it. And I think that the availability of peat to the organisms on the North Slope represents, you know, an additional source of energy that is being utilized by organisms large and small to keep them going.
Sounds good. Has anything else you'd like to add?
Nothing. Think of right off the top.
Thank you.
The two major processes that put peat into the, well, I guess you would say there's three. as the rivers meander back and forth, especially during the spring flood. Over 70% of the water on the North Slope rivers comes off during a 2 or 3 week period in June, which is when the snow melts sort of in one big rush and it comes off in a spring flood. During this time, the riverbanks are eroded very rapidly, and that's when the major blocks of permafrost collapse into the river. On the coastline, it's a different process. Whenever you have a storm move through, usually late in the summer, the seawater will rise in a storm surge, and this causes a very rapid erosion of the coastline. And once again, the polygonal tundra collapses big blocks of sand and gravel covered with peat into the nearshore environment. And on the lakes, it's sort of a different process there. The wind stress across the lakes sets up a peripheral current in the lake, and it's this little current that erodes the permafrost blocks, usually at the northeast and southwest ends of the lake, and causes them to collapse into the water and spreads the peat across the bottom.